Good morning. I'm going to talk about two things, really, about measuring cluster supernova rates in clusters, and then trying to...
Can you turn yourself off?
I'm not on?
I didn't see you.
I am on. There's a green light.
There will be editing.
I can explain how.
Yeah.
Quiet, folks. So the first part is about measuring supernova rates in clusters as a function of redshift, and the second is about trying to push high redshift searches, also in search of rates, for supernovae from the ground, trying to push the limits of what we can do from ground-based telescopes. So first, about supernova rates in clusters. Why are clusters a good place to try to study metal enrichment? Well, they're simple systems. They don't have any star formation going on. They're quiet, and they're most important, they're like Hotel Californias. You can check out, but you can never leave, and all the stuff that's ever been formed there is still there. So we can see the total products of all the supernovae that have gone on, try to understand what happened. Plus, from the practical point of view of looking for supernovae, there's many galaxies in a small field, so that's an efficient place to look for supernovae. Now let's review a few facts about clusters. Most of the baryons are not in the galaxies and the stars, but rather in the intracluster gas, which you can see in this picture of 2218 and X-rays here, this region here. And when this gas is observed in X-rays, then it has this kind of thermal free-free spectrum, and there's emission lines on it. For example, this emission line here, which we zoom in, is iron. It's the strongest line, and it can be quite reliably translated into abundances. And looking at those abundances of the various elements, that's the traditional way of trying to figure out which supernovae produced what elements in the ICM. I call these fossil studies. A very recent example of this is by this paper by De Vlaedal, a Dutch group. And these are the results of trying to fit the abundances of various elements. I don't know if you can read this, silicon, sulfur, argon, et cetera. And the measurements are getting to be quite accurate with the latest X-ray satellites with XMM Chandra. So you see the error bars here are quite small. And what they've tried to do here, which is the traditional approach, is to take theoretical yields for core collapse supernovae integrated over the IMF and for 1As, that's the blue curves and the red curves respectively, and try to see which combination of the two can fit the observed abundances. And what you see here is that no combination does very well. In particular, they can't fit this high calcium to argon ratio. So the next step they do is they fiddle around with the 1A yields. Simply, they do it by hand, using an approach used by Badenis et al. To match the observed abundances in the Tycho supernova remnant. And then they do a bit better, as you can see here. But formally, this is still inconsistent with the data. So there is some problem, a problem at some level. But if you take their best fit, one thing you notice here is that almost all of the iron comes from 1As, about 97% if I eyeball it. And in terms of the relative numbers of 1As to core collapse supernova, they're about 1-to-1. About half of the supernovae that went off in the cluster were core collapse, and half were 1As. But apparently there is a problem here, and it depends on these theoretical yields.
But I'm not going to let this statement go by with this. 15-40% of stars end the 3-day go 1A. But you're just
right. This is one of the conclusions of their paper that
people believe that 97% of the iron is created by 1As.
Right.
And that's probably a true statement.
Right. This results directly from saying that there's a 1-to-1 ratio between core collapse and 1A. If you then assume an IMF, then you know how many.
But we know in star forming galaxies, it's a 1-to-3 ratio.
That's right. So they're saying something quite different.
Okay.
Okay, and that means that that a huge fraction of the things that we think that can go 1A have actually become 1As. Almost all of them.
This is all in the context of 1As that are popping up through star formation. Right? So in an old world, we know that only 1 in 100 white dwarfs is slower than 1A. It's in an old population. That we know. It's integrated over all the time.
Exactly. Okay, so what you just said, we don't know. Actually, and after I've prepared this morning another slide, some people saw it as they were coming in, that tries to get at this number from many different aspects, just compiled from the literature. So this is, and you'll see that many of them are quite high. This means that basically almost everything that can become a 1A does, and maybe more than what can become a 1A does, because remember that not all things that start out as late B or early A type stars are in binaries, yeah. And not all of the right masses are close enough to become 1As.
You also don't solve the 1As with ellipticals this way, I would presume.
We'll get back to this. Okay. It is very interesting. Okay. So alternatively, instead of doing these fossil studies, we can do something else. We can actually look back in time, look to higher redshifts, and see this process in action, or at least the late tail of it. And see what is actually producing the metals. And in the process, as I'll show, we can also try to figure out what is its loading in 1As. Now, let's try first to make a prediction of what the 1A rate versus redshift would look like in clusters. To do that, we should note that the metallicity of the ISN is quite high. And if you recall that most of the baryons are in this gas, this translates into a very large mass of iron. And it seems that all this iron is already in place back at redshift 1. This is this 0.4 solar metallicity in iron. And this is by this paper. Just yesterday there was another one by these authors in AstroPH showing basically the same result.
They directly measure the hydrogen? So they're measuring
FeOnH. They actually directly measure the iron. Okay, they measure an iron mass.
I understand, but do they actually measure a hydrogen mass in blood?
No.
So it's all ionized, so it's...
No, they get an NEC from the brimstone.
Yeah. Right. That's clumping. Right. That's right. That's where the hydrogen comes from.
So there's clumping. There's probably a clumping uncertainty when you do the NE-squared intervals for the X-ray. Okay. If you assume it's uniform, you should be able to get a total X-ray emitting gas mass.
Right.
But if there's clumping, it's not uniform, then you're screwed. You have to do SZ.
Okay. I think I...
Yeah, but this number is very robust. It's been, been there for a long time. It's not going to go away. And they even... I think both studies think they see a rise actually at low redshift, which is pretty strange. We know how many with this total mass of iron, and given that we know actually quite directly how much iron the different types of supernovae produce, because this is what's driving the optical light curve. So these are numbers we can more or less measure directly. We can say how many supernovae have gone off in a cluster. If we look at on the number of stars that we see in clusters today, and we assume some standard IMF, we can say how many high mass stars have exploded in the past. And it's been known now for over 15 years that if you do this and you try to reproduce the observed amount of iron that you see in X-rays with core collapse supernovae, then you have a factor of 5 discrepancy. You see a lot more iron than you would expect just from core collapse supernovae. So one solution to this problem has been, I don't know if you can see this, is to say, well, the stars that you see there today were formed with a top-heavy IMF. So even though there aren't that many there today, there were lots of massive stars that exploded and produced all this iron via core collapse supernovae. Or the alternative solution is that most of it is from 1As, which is what most people believe. As we heard in Brian's talk on Tuesday, there are various paths, theoretical paths, to form a 1A. And as this plot that Lev made some years ago shows, And some people are in the business of actually calculating the delay functions that result from each of these paths, meaning the star formation rate as a, the supernova rate as a function of time following a short burst of star formation. So these dashed lines are models that, that Lev calculated, and these solid curves are just parametrized models that I'll get to later. So that's been one approach. Another approach has been to say, well, let's just assume that these delay functions are have some simple parametric form, as Madaudow have assumed, and this is our own version of these plots. So you have a short burst of star formation, and this is the rate of supernovae as a function of time. And these are for three different parameterizations for characteristic delay times of 1, 2, or 3 giga-years. Now this, in fact, is more or less what you expect to see in clusters, because we know from just looking at the stellar populations that all of the star formation in clusters occurred a long time ago at redshift 2 or 2.5 or so, and nothing much has been happening there. So this is effectively is the supernova rate in clusters that you would expect. Of course, when you actually observe a cluster, you're not looking at time, but you're looking at redshift. So if, for example, all the stars in a cluster formed at redshift 2, this would be the supernova rate as a function of redshift for each of these parametrized models. Or if all the stars formed at redshift 3, it would look like this. And the total number of supernovae that are produced, that are plotted in each of these models, have all been normalized to give the right amount of iron. Okay, if we go back a step, okay, all these curves have the same area under them, so they all have the same number of super of 1As that produce the right amount of iron, and this is true also in these plots, but it's just plotted versus redshift, so it doesn't look that way, but all of these produce the right amount of iron. And we know exactly, pretty much exactly, how much what that normalization has to be, right? Because we just have to take the mass of iron that we have, okay, and divide it by the yield of each 1A, which is pretty close to 0.7 solar masses of iron, okay. And this number here, the iron mass to stellar luminosity today in clusters, is something that's measured quite accurately. So we can plug in these numbers, and this is the result that we get. We get that there's, for every stellar luminosity that we see in clusters today, there's been 0.04 of a supernova 1A sometime in the past. If all the iron that we see is indeed from 1As. Okay, and this means a time-integrated rate that's really quite high. Okay, if you remember this number, this is a very high rate. So this is already telling us that there were a lot of supernovae in the past.
What would happen if the late times were a little bit longer? Like, say, the late
times? Well, I'm considering a whole range of delay times. Okay. Even longer. Okay. Well, I'm going to show some examples of that.
This is the thing that's fixed.
That's right.
Which is
the integral is
product
fixed.
Of iron.
So. Okay, so the shape is, we don't know at the delay time, but the integral is fixed. Okay, so this is the same plot that I just showed, and now we have basically a prediction or a set of predictions for what the rate might look like as a function of time for different progenitor scenarios, if you will. Okay, because each progenitor scenario supposedly will give you a different delay function. This is just a zoom on the low redshift part of the same plot. So you have here a bunch of models, and now if you go to the observations, until recently there were none, or very few to speak of. There were some rough attempts to estimate the cluster supernova rates in the 70s. Brian had a student, David Reese, whose thesis was to measure it at low redshift. He got a measurement, but it was never published. A few years ago, we tried to get some rough rates by analyzing archival HST data of clusters, clusters that had been imaged several times, looking for the supernovae. We found a very small number, about 3 or so, which we put in different redshift bins, and we calculated rates with huge error bars, as you see here, which aren't very constrained. So clearly, in order to select among these models, you want some modern and accurate measurements of rates. And this is something that we're trying to do. We have ongoing programs to measure cluster rates at various redshifts, and I'll show you examples of two of those sub-programs at low redshift and at high redshift. So first, at low redshift, Avishai Galiam's thesis project was to measure the rate in a low redshift cluster sample. We did this with our own telescope in Israel at the Wise Observatory. And he found about a dozen supernovae, about half of which were actually in the clusters, based on spectroscopic follow-up with Keck that Alex Filipenko and Raja Guatakurta did. So here are the actual supernovae. Actually, deriving a rate from these numbers was Karen Sharon's thesis. And this is a paper that came out a couple of months ago in AstroPH. And I won't bore you with all the details of actually transforming those 6 supernovae and all the observations into a rate, but Karen sweated over it a long time. You have to actually determine the efficiencies of each of a few thousand images and calculate control times and so on, and estimate luminosities, stellar luminosities for all these clusters, because in the end you want to normalize your rate by luminosity. We use Sloan for this. In the end, here's the number that she got. This is the 1A rate at redshift, clusters at redshift 0.1. And we can also, this is in units relative to stellar luminosity. Today it's becoming more popular to express things relative to stellar mass following work by Manucci et al. So here is the result. Okay, about one supernova per century per 10, 0.1 supernova per century per 10 to the 10th solar masses. So if we now go back to these predictions and we put the first accurate...
Can you apply your error bars on that?
Could I? Did I what?
No, the error, sorry, the snoop per mass is, we have an extra zero, missing a zero in it?
Yeah. Yes.
In
yes. Sorry about that. Okay, so.
Let me show you guys. So 1 in 1,000 years for 10 to the 10 solar masses.
Yes. So it's quite low, and here's the point now. Okay, so you can see here that it's actually quite low, and we're actually already ruling out many of these models that you asked about. Longer delay times, are going to be, you know, even up here. So that you could already tell before that they aren't working.
How does that compare to the field rate?
Okay, so. Okay, so here's we wanted to compare. Here's our number in SNU Bs or in SNU Ms per stellar mass. And within the errors, after you add the zeros, they're consistent, but this seems to be somewhat larger. Okay, and I wondered about that. So I asked I asked Filippo Manucci.
But the legacy survey agreed with Manucci, is what I remember, the Sullivan paper.
That's right, but that's at higher redshift.
I understand.
E plus S zero on
the so it's per mass.
That's right.
Yes, correct. Well,
but they have E plus S zero also, Sullivan and
I understand, but we have.
Okay, but. Okay, so I wondered. You know, whether there's in if you go to the Asiago and so on data, whether you can separate the E's as zeros to those that are in clusters and those that aren't, because obviously among the local E's that they monitored, some are in Virgo and Fornax and so on, and some are not. So I asked Filippo if he could do this, and he said he didn't know which ones are in clusters and which aren't. But then we figured a way of just doing this with Ned. Karen did this. And we gave him two lists of those that certainly are in clusters and those that are not in clusters. And he measured the rates again, and surprisingly, here are the numbers that he got. This is the published rate, okay? But now if he splits it into clusters and field, he gets a significantly higher rate in clusters, okay? And one that is actually quite close to the number that we got, which was 0.98, you remember. Okay, so their published rate for early type galaxies is really a mean between two different rates. So we started looking for what could be driving this, and as you recall, there was a paper several years ago by De La Valle showing that radio loud galaxies have a higher supernova 1A rate than radio quiet galaxies. So we said, well, maybe those are in clusters, so what we're really seeing is the same effect. But it turns out that the two things drive the 1A rate separately. And if you separate the low redshift sample into things that are both in clusters and radio loud, as opposed to things that are in the field and radio quiet, the difference becomes almost an order of magnitude. Okay, so each of these things, the radio loudness and the environment, are both important for the rate. And this is completely counter to what you would expect, because as we've all heard, the 1A rate is higher in star-forming environments. So you'd think that clusters, which are a much quieter environment than the field, you'd have a lower rate, but this is going in the opposite direction. And another thing we suspected was that maybe this is something to do with metallicity. Maybe the metallicity in clusters is higher, and that's why the rate is higher. But there's a good proxy for metallicity, which is mass. In early type galaxies, mass correlates very well with metallicity. So we separated the sample according to mass to see whether the supernova rate cluster correlates with mass, and it doesn't. Okay, so it really is environment. Somehow the supernovae and clusters know that they're in clusters.
So the rate of the WISE survey of field to cluster was about 50-50.
We didn't derive a field rate.
The actual detections.
Yeah. But some of the field galaxies were core collapsed. Oh, actually, just one. Right. Okay. This is just in graphical form. This is the distance of one of the Asiago early type galaxies from the center of a known cluster in megaparsecs, and this is a supernova rate. So it's still sort of at the 2 to 3 sigma level, but it's quite suggestive. Okay, let's go back to the main topic, which is measuring cluster rates at higher redshift. We had a program with HST that ran through cycles 14 and now, and fortunately we got about 80% of our data just before ACS died. Avishai is the PI on this. Sorry?
It's just sleep.
And additional collaborators, including some of the people here in the room, are involved in this too. And this has been going quite well. I'll just show you quickly some examples of supernovae and clusters that we found. On average, we're finding about a supernova in each field, more or less, that we find. Sometimes none, sometimes two. Here's an example of two at this redshift, at this cluster at redshift 0.57. Okay, if we look first at this one, this is clearly a galaxy that's not in the cluster. This is the separate sub-exposures where here's the total. The new exposure, here's the old exposure of the same cluster. So this is an inverse supernova. It produces a hole in the image subtraction, and you can see that it's there in every sub-exposure, so it's not, we know it's not a cosmic ray and so on. Here's another example of another cluster at redshift 0.8. Again, with two candidates, this thing is clearly a foreground galaxy. The cluster is this thing here. So there it is. And right here is another early type galaxy that is in the cluster. There's a spectra that were taken for it previously, so we know it's a cluster galaxy. And here a supernova shows up in a different image. It seems to be pretty close to the nucleus, but the spectra, which are quite high signal noise of this galaxy, show no AGN or anything like that. So we think this is, in fact, a supernova, and it's a supernova in an early type galaxy, so it's probably a 1A. So these are the kind of things that we're looking at. So this is one cluster 1A in our belt. Yeah, we try to get Keck spectra of them. They're usually quite faint. So whether there's a supernova or not in the spectrum is usually kind of on the hairy edge. But we do get a spectra for all the hosts. So we at least know if it's a cluster or a field and what kind of galaxy it is. And here, this I have to show. This is a cluster that we observed for another reason. It's a lens. It's the largest separation lensed quasar. So 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 over in the middle are quintuply imaged quasar at redshift 1.7, while the cluster is at 0.68. And there's all sorts of other stuff here. Apart from the quasar, there's this, and this are all, and this radial arc here are all images of the galaxy at redshift 3.3. And there's it does. It's right here. Okay, we had two epochs on it, and sure enough, you know, now you see it, now you don't.
What's the expected time delay to the other lenses?
Well, this is actually in the cluster.
Oh.
Okay, we got spectra for this pair of galaxies, and the redshift is actually a bit higher than you know the central galaxy. It seems like this is a superposition of two clusters of slightly different redshifts. So this is at about 0.7 or so. We don't have a rate yet for this. But this is going to be part of Kevin's thesis too. But we more or less know where to put the point now, because in order to get the HST time, we have to say how many supernovae we expect, and we're not seeing as many as we thought we would. Okay, we're getting quite few. We made our estimate based on this earlier measurement here, and we're getting maybe only about half or a third as many as we expected. So we have to do this thoroughly, but with PowerPoint it's very easy to put data wherever you want. So it's clear that our measurement is going to be somewhere here. You know, it's not going to be up here. So we're already getting a feel for where this is going.
That's per unit mass, right?
No, this is actually per unit luminosity.
Yeah.
B.
So that's a little, you got some work to do to get that mass, because of the color evolution of passing galaxies.
There's not that much evolution in these.
Well, at B? Yes. What are you at?
It's pretty okay.
It's passive evolution, so yeah. It's pretty easy.
No, I know, it's easy to do. Yeah. But it matters, 0.7 to 0 at B.
No, I agree. But presumably you've done passive evolution.
We haven't done anything yet. I've just put this on the PowerPoint. Okay, this is just a rough estimate of where this point is going to be, or rather where it's not going to be. Okay, so what we see here is that the rates not only are low, as we've seen, but they pretty much stay low. Okay, and what this means in terms of progenitors and so on is that if all this iron that we see in the ICM came from 1As, it happened long ago before we were looking, okay, up at high redshift. So that means you have to push these curves, the high rate part of them, up to high redshift, okay, and that means a short delay. Okay, so this is really pushing us in the same direction as that you guys. Where's Evan? Okay, but I'll talk more about this in a little bit. Okay, if the iron comes from 1As, it has to be a short delay. That's what these measurements are saying. And this is by the direct approach of actually looking back in time and seeing the enrichment in action as opposed to the fossil approach. So it's a lot more direct. Let me now go to the second subject, which is supernova rates in the field. This is really a very similar game, only there's a further complication when you do it in the field. Here, too, for different models, you have different delay functions. But now, your star formation history isn't something like a short burst, but it's the Madal plot, or whatever you call it. And then to actually get your supernova rate as a function of time, cosmic time, or redshift, you have to convolve this with this. And then you get, for example, this kind of supernova rate versus redshift. You can go ahead and now try to measure redshifts in the field, rates in the field of different redshifts. Or better yet, you can multiply this by your visibility time at every redshift, your control time at every redshift, how long you would see a supernova if it was there. And that way you can get your observed supernova redshift distribution. This is better in the sense that you model forward and you don't fiddle with your data. So this is another way of getting at the same thing, but now you have to know also your star formation history, which of course people have been fighting over for about 10 years now. I think the first attempt to actually do this comparison with data was done by Avishai and myself a few years ago. We took various star formation histories that were around then and convolved them with different delay functions, and we compared to the very small Supernova 1A data set that existed then, which was from the Supernova Cosmology Project, consisted of about 10 1As out to redshift 1. And we concluded that depending on what star formation history we chose, we could rule out some models. Specifically, we could rule out things with short delay times. Okay, this is quite opposite to what we found in clusters. On the other hand, if we picked a different star formation history, then the data were less constrained. But this was based on a very small amount of data. And things got exciting a little bit later with the HST Goods project, which found 25 supernovae 1A out to redshift 1.6. And they did this same kind of analysis. They tried, different parameterizations of the delay functions, these kind of things which are similar to the ones that I showed you in my plot for clusters, but also these kind of delay functions which are just Gaussians shifted in time. And surprisingly, over here, this is what they chose as their favored model. If we compare this again to this plot of the physical models calculated by Jungelson and Livio, you see that this isn't really similar to any of these. It's quite different, especially when you plot it on a linear scale. People usually do these on logarithmic scales. On a linear scale, this really does not look like anything. But this is what they say fits their data. And here is the actual data. This is the actual observed redshift distribution of the supernovae in Goods going from redshift 0 to 2, so all these bar plots are the same. And these curves are their adopted star formation history convolved with the various delay functions, either the exponential one or these Gaussians, and with different time delays. And here is their best fit. Now, you might get an impression that many of these things that are formally rejected are not really that different from this best fit model. And furthermore, if you look at the numbers here, you'll see that a lot of this result is really driven by this very high redshift bin, which has one supernova at redshift 1.6. In other words, if there were two or three there, which maybe were there, but just they were lost or they were unlucky and didn't see them, then the conclusions might have been different. After that, quite a lot of people got into this game. Here's a brief summary of other works that have tried to do this same exercise of measuring the redshift distribution of supernovae, or equivalently the supernova 1A rate as a function of redshift, and deducing what is the time delay. So as we saw in clusters, we found out that the delay time must be short, or maybe the iron is from some other source, not from 1As. And now in the field, this was our first study which favored this kind of longish delay for some star formation histories. Then these are the results I just showed you by Strolger et al. And Dallin et al. With this Gaussian delay function shifted by 4 giga-years. A little bit after that, Barris and Tonry did their own supernova survey from the ground, the IFA supernova survey, and they found actually opposite results. They argued that the delay time is only 1 giga-year, and they also compared the results to goods and reached the same conclusion that I just stated, that this result really hinges heavily on that one point, or that one supernova at very high redshift. And that if these results are, if they're analyzed only for things that are up to redshift 1, then they also favor this kind of short time delay, which would be consistent with what we saw in the clusters. Okay, another interesting work.
If you added 2 supernova to that last bin, you might get it down to 2 giga-years, but pushing it all the way down to 1 giga-year is pretty tough just by
Well, this
it's Poisson is keeping you out of that bin, or it's lack of ultraviolet light that's keeping you out of that bin. That is it systematic, or is it?
The next paper on this list actually is an attempt to address this by Forster et al., where they've, as opposed to these guys, they've looked at a whole series of star formation histories that are still plausible, and different forms of delay functions, and their conclusion actually is that you really can't tell. Okay, you can't say whether it's this or that. And then things got really interesting with all these papers, first by Manucci et al., then by Lars and Evan, and then by these results from the Legacy survey. All of which find evidence that there's really 2 populations. It's not a simple delay function. There's a prompt population and a delayed population. And if you assume that, you can explain perhaps all the observations.
But one population may be dominated in spirals and young,
that's right,
young quartz star formation is prevalent, and the other in E plus S zeros.
That's right.
Correct. Yeah.
Plus, there's the complication that...
For which there's evidence.
Yeah. That...
That's the source of this whole idea.
Right. There are underluminous 1As that are incompletely sampled, aren't there? And I don't know where they come from or where they belong in these...
They're in the old population. The 91BDs, the very subluminous, are in the old population.
In the old population.
Correct.
And they don't produce much iron.
That's right.
And
they don't produce much... Well, no, you don't know that. You don't know that.
They don't fit the Phillips relation.
Very little nickel. Yes, they do.
The underluminous ones?
Yes, they're on the extended.
That's why they're underluminous.
They're on the extension of the Phillips range. Yes. Right? Peter would say.
Oh, so you're worried about that?
They're on the Gardner relation.
Okay. You have to show me after this talk what that looks like. Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm not gonna stay on this argument of what the delay time is.
Let me make one point. So we were nice in the sense that there's one reason you can rule out the Strolger profile, which is sort of an embarrassment, but we didn't do it. I mean, we did it, but we didn't publish it.
Well,
we didn't
tell us.
Well, if you really have a shifted Gaussian with a delay of 4 giga-years, imagine you have a spiral with a declining star formation range. And that means at early times in the spiral, you don't see any 1As. And then there comes an age where the 1A to core collapse rate is like 10 to 1 or 100 to 1. Because all of the accumulated things that haven't popped off, you have a shifted Gaussian, are now popping off. So if you plot the 1A to core collapse rate as a function of age of the galaxy,
it's 0, 0, and then it goes to 10 or 50, and then it goes down. So, you know, you can rule that out.
But how do you know that doesn't happen?
There's nothing in the Minucci paper that would tell us that that's what's going on for the 1-eta. You don't see it. You'd see it in the m-dot relation. So you don't. So I think.
Okay.
That's for the shifted Gaussian, not the one that starts at zero and just goes. This is that nobody's on for 3D years.
Shifted Gaussian.
I'd like to actually to get the big picture out of all these numbers. I think, and I think you'll agree with me, is that everybody really more or less is saying the same thing, except for these guys, okay? Because this and what we said in clusters
Correct.
Is really the same thing as what you guys are saying.
Right. So I think the way to say it is
right because
it's really just a trivial mathematical statement. If you want to fit all the data with an e folding of a gigayear, you cannot do it.
Right.
Because e to the minus 10 is really a small number. You can't get stuff in old populations.
Exactly.
It's a trivial.
Or in other words, going too far back. Okay. In other words, this 1 gigayear model,
right.
Okay, is the same as two populations, right? There's most of it is here, and then there's a long tail. This is really saying the same thing.
There is Laura Greyjoy, who is strongly against the view of the front of the target. She says that simple reasoning on star formation and evolution of the system, you just have a very broad distribution of the delay times. Mm-hmm. And this comes naturally and explain all the observable.
Can explain the Minucci et al. Result?
The iron enrichment, you do have to get a lot of the iron very early after the starburst.
You have a broad.
So whatever it is, the function looks like something which is very peaked at a gigayear and then has some shape between 2 and 13, which we're debating about, but an 8 e to the minus 1 t over a gigayear.
I don't want to depend on the arguments of others, but
sure.
It seems rather convincing in this article if you don't know yet. The topic of last year by Laura Greyjoy. Well, I can give you the.
Okay, so I'm a mere observer, so I'm not going to try to understand all the physics of this, but it is clear that one needs better and larger samples, especially to check if this sharp decline in the rate at redshifts about 1.5 or so are true. So there's actually, or there was until ACS died. A second version of HST goods going on to double the sample. Actually, it was done, right? So the Hubble diagram part of it was actually published. They haven't published yet rates or reanalysis a la Strolger and Dowen. But that will still only double the sample. We'd like really an order of magnitude improvement.
It might be politic to add to that slide sky number.
We're low redshift.
No, that's low redshift.
It's too low.
Yeah, they're not interested.
You want things that you can take a spectra of.
I want things that you can study. They want things.
That's right. Okay, but that is in fact the problem, that even with goods, only some of those objects were followed up with spectroscopy. So there is a worry there that some of the things are not 1As or not normal 1As, and the problem is that when you go to these redshifts, it's unavoidable. You're talking about things that are very, very faint. So even with the largest telescopes and with a lot of time, you can't do anything about them.
But the HST observations, because they're in the rest frame ultraviolet, are actually very good at telling you whether you have a 1A or something that's not a 1A.
You mean with the ACS Grism?
No, I mean from the photometry.
Just from the photometry.
Yeah, because the contrast between a 1A and other things in the ultraviolet colors is very big.
Okay, that's going to be the next topic. Okay, so we've been thinking of ways of doing this, of getting larger samples of high redshift supernovae, and then thinking of ways of how to follow them up, given their faintness. And this is actually something that is worthwhile doing for other reasons too, because very, very soon, about a year, we're going to start having many thousands or tens of thousands of supernovae from pan stars, and 10 years from now we're going to have millions of supernovae. There's no way we can do spectroscopic follow-up of those just because of their sheer numbers. So there's a general need for a different approach to doing supernova rate studies that doesn't rely on spectroscopy. And all this has led to this project that has been going on now for 2 years using Subaru. And in this are involved, in addition to the people I already noticed, already mentioned, this Japanese team, except for Buell Januzzi, who's not Japanese yet. And two years ago, we got two nights on Subaru using SupremeCam, which is, in terms of Antendu, that's by an order of magnitude better than any imager on any telescope in the world. It has a half degree by half degree field of view and an 8 meter with superb image quality. Some years before, the Japanese had produced the Subaru Deep Field, which is which they imaged in five broad bands and two narrow bands to about 27th magnitude. And we decided to simply go back to this field and re-image it in three of the bands, in R, I, and Z, R, I, and Z, to similar depth. And we expected in just this one shot on one small field to find about 50 supernovae going out to these kind of redshifts, the same kind of redshifts that Goods got to, but from the ground. And here's, in fact, a prediction that we put in our proposal for what would be the number of supernovae per redshift interval for core collapse supernovae, making some assumptions, and for 1As in blue for different delay times. So if you look at the numbers, we're talking about of order several tens of each type. And we did this. Here's the actual SDF. So every little dot there is a galaxy. If we zoom in on here, you can see it more clearly. Or if you zoom in on this little area over here in color.
What is typical scene?
It's very nice. We just had another run, as I'll mention, a month ago, and it was half an arc second almost throughout the run, sometimes even 0.45 in all three bands. So it's an amazing telescope. Okay, so it's there's about 160,000 galaxies in there, down to 27th magnitude. And in fact, we found a supernovae. Here are some examples. This is the original epoch. This is the new epoch. Here's a supernova, and in the difference, here's another one. You kind of sort of see it over here. It comes out in the difference. And here's another one where you barely see anything here, and here it is. And here's a partial mosaic of the things we found, just to impress you, every time, first epoch, second epoch, and difference. So in fact, we are finding quite a few things that are supernovae. We've observed this field with the Kitt Peak 4 meter and several epochs to root out the AGNs, and also the original SDF was taken on various epochs, so that gives us a handle on AGNs. So we think we have a pretty clean sample of supernovae. Now, what do you do with these things? Brian was talking about things that he's only going down to 18.5 magnitude because he can't do spectroscopy beyond that. Our brightest supernovae are 24th, and most of them are 25th, 26th magnitude, or even 27th. So there's forget about spectroscopy. You can do spectroscopy sometimes for the hosts, but often you can't even do that, so you have to rely on photometric Z. But you can do that pretty well in this field because the original SDF was observed in those seven bands. So here's an example of one of the hosts, and the best fit photo Z. And as I'll discuss in a minute, this, by the way, this whole project is Dovi Poznanski's PhD thesis. He's about to finish his PhD. So this whole analysis was done by him, and in the course of this work, he's become a devout Bayesian, and he's built this whole Bayesian apparatus for properly analyzing these data. So he talks only about probabilities and distributions. So for this specific case, rather than saying what is the photo Z of the host galaxy, he tells us what is the actual probability distribution of redshifts. And here's a different galaxy with a somewhat less well-defined probability distribution for the redshift. So that's the easy part. But then you have to go to the supernovae themselves and say, ask what they are. You're getting a mix of core collapse and 1A supernova, and you certainly want to separate them out if you want to do any physics at all. So how can one tell apart supernovae based on photometry only, which is what we have? This is something that we've been working on already for several years with things like this in mind. In this set of papers, Dovi and Avishai showed that under some conditions you can separate out different supernova types in color space, and this is something that is well known, but we try to investigate it more systematically and thoroughly. For example, if you plot in Ri versus I minus Z the tracks of 1As as a function of time, then they do this kind of thing. Okay, while 2Ps do this kind of thing. This is all based on taking spectra of nearby supernovae. Redshifting them to, in this case, to Z equals 1. And then synthesizing photometry through filters and putting in all the effects, putting in extinction before... before doing the photometry, who asked about this yesterday? Okay, so you see that if your supernova happens to fall here, you don't know what it is, but in many cases you can tell what it is. Of course, this is oversimplified because there are other kinds of supernovae. There's the 1BCs and the 2Ns, so it becomes something of a mess. But still, there are some regions of color space where you can say that this is definitely a 1A and not something else. And of course, not all the information that you have is included in this plot. There's the actual magnitude. And if you have more than one epoch, you also know if the light curve is rising or falling. So you can actually improve on this. And in the latest version of this this idea to classify supernovae based on photometry only, Dovi has built a whole Bayesian machine that takes all the observational information and compares it to a library of templates at all possible different redshifts and host extinctions and galactic extinction and so on, and tries to decide whether something is more likely a 1A or more likely a core collapse supernova, because that's the main physical distinction that we want to make. And this is all in a probabilistic sense. Okay, we know that we're going to be wrong in some of the cases, but at least it can tell us what things are in a probabilistic case. And to see if his machine really works, he's applied it to several samples where we have both photometry and spectroscopy. One is the Supernova Legacy Survey that have very nice light curves for their supernovae, both core collapse and 1As, and they have spectra. So we know what the true answer is, but we can then pretend we don't know what things are. We take the photometry, we put it into the machine, and we ask it, do you think it's a 1A or a core collapse? And the results are actually quite encouraging. For example, here is the probability. Here's the classification that the machine gives for things that we know are in fact 1As, and 97% of those, in fact, it tells us they're 1As. And this depends to some degree on how good your photo Z is. Okay, so this is for different photo Zs, but for reasonable photo Zs with an error of say 0.1, which is typical, you still get a very high fraction. If you take the SNLS 2Ps and you see how well they do, they don't do as well. There you have only a 76% success fraction, but that's still better than random. Okay, so for a large sample, this is telling you something. This is helping you classify your supernovae. Right, but what's the fraction of false positive? Well, that depends on what the intrinsic fraction is. But if you know that, you could easily calculate that. Okay, but of course there are, this is just for 2Ps and 1As. What about other types of supernovae? So to answer this question, Dovi has created a simulated sample that has all of the different types and found what is the success rate for different supernova ages on this axis and different redshifts. So you see that the algorithm for different redshifts and ages has different degrees of success. For black here is good. It means a high success fraction. And the limit between the 50-50 limit, which is what counts really, is this thick dark line. So you see that for 1As, at most redshifts and at most ages, you're doing very well. For 2Ps, you're doing not as well, but still pretty good. 1BCs is kind of okay, still better than random. And 2Ns usually fail, which is a well-known problem. 2Ns have similar colors to 1As. So many 1A samples that are classified only based on photometry could have a strong 2N contamination.
This is from a single measurement.
Single epoch.
Yeah, all this is based on single epoch.
Okay. You can play the game, obviously, with this fact. What's the right cadence to start helping you out?
That's right. Okay, so we have now we have this tool, which basically can tell us whether something is more likely core collapse or 1A. So here's its application to one of the actual SDF candidates. And here is an example of something that is very likely core collapse rather than 1A. Okay, there's a 79% probability that's a 1A. Or here's one that's almost certainly a 1A, 99%, and not a core collapse. And here is one that's sort of 50-50. We don't know. Now, you certainly wouldn't want to use this to put things on a Hubble diagram, but we don't care about that. Okay, we want to measure rates. We want to measure supernova distributions as a function of redshift. Okay, and for that, it's okay to count half supernovae, for example, in this case. If we have a large enough sample, our errors, if they're not biased in some direction, in the end, should cancel. So this is the approach we're taking, and here are some preliminary results from that first run. This plot is sort of outdated by now, but it gives the right picture. Here's the cumulative counts of supernovae we're finding as a function of Z magnitude. This goes out to 27, but we really believe our candidate's only out to Z of about 26, which is here. So you see we have comparable numbers of 1As and 1Cs, and in total about 30 or so supernovae in this one shot in two nights. And if we should ignore these numbers, this is a little higher, but if we compare this now to goods, which is this magenta line, okay, going with the same magnitude, we're actually doing quite similar. I mean, we got a similar sample of supernovae, but with a fraction of the effort and the cost and from the ground. In terms of answering the interesting questions, whether there are 1As at high redshift, we still can't answer that because our sample is really not much bigger than goods at this point. But I view the importance of this really as a proof of concept, because this is just before I finish the sentence. This is the actual redshift distribution of the supernovae we found after we've separated them in this probabilistic sense to 1As and core collapse. And if you compare now this to the things that we predicted in the proposal, you see that we did quite well. If the red points, which are the core collapse, the numbers are quite similar. You have to multiply this axis by 10 to compare, and they peak at pretty much the right redshift. And the 1As, where we had the distribution in these ranges depending on the time delay, is pretty much along that line with a peak at around 0.7. So we are finding the more or less the things that we were expecting, and we are finding also things that are at quite high redshift. okay, the redshift that will really decide between the delay functions eventually. But as I started to say, this is really just a proof of concept. And to make this work, you have to do it again and again to accumulate a sizable sample. But that's quite easy to do, because every time you revisit this field, you get another crop of about 40 supernovae. You do it 10 times, you'll have 400 supernovae. And that's something you can already work with. And in fact, we managed to convince the Subaru tech that this is the case. We got more time to do it this year. We had another run just a month ago, which was very successful. It was, we went very deep with the beautiful seeing. And we have another run scheduled for May.
But isn't the time better spent, you know, doing something 20 days later instead of 3
No, then you're going to see the same supernovae.
No. That's my point. Yes.
I don't want to see the same. I want the field to refresh.
Well, another thing would be to say, if you know the color evolution of the supernovae, and so that way you would be much more certain.
Yeah, I would classify them better.
Yeah.
Okay, but
so the question is,
ideally Subaru should do only this all the time.
But then you have to show at some point that you don't have some systematic error built into your classifier.
That's right.
And that you say it's 95%, but you know, is it really? So somehow there has to be some ground truth on that.
Well,
at the redshift that you're talking about.
Well, okay. Well, first of all, I demonstrated that with real samples.
Well, but
with SNLS, and I know it was done all.
It doesn't go to 1.6.
No, we did it for goods too. I didn't mention it. Okay, it's in the paper though. The paper describing this is also an Astro pH. It works very well for goods, for those supernovae and goods that have spectroscopic confirmation. It does almost 100%.
That's because we did. We selected them by kind of a photometric thing, and then took.
No. Goods, you know, goods had lots of supernovae. Okay, and then there's the gold, bronze, and crap, and whatever. Okay, and there's spectroscopy for all of the gold and for some of the others. What?
Yeah.
It doesn't. That's not what it means to be gold.
Well, you need more than that.
Yeah. Okay. So we found that those with spectroscopy,
sure,
we identify them correctly almost always, as opposed to those that are without spectroscopy. We almost always disagree.
Okay.
Yeah, so the question is, nobody knows who is right. But it does work out to high redshifts even with goods, for things that have spectroscopy.
I mean, the way it worked was, we used a photometric selection that's, you know, has the same idea in it.
Yeah.
And then when we had to choose which objects to take spectra of, we took spectra of the ones that met the photometric standard.
Right. So there is some bias.
That's why. Oh, it's not just bias. It's cause and effect.
What does it mean when you say a supernova is a 50-50 chance of being a core collapse and a 1A? If your information goes to zero, is that number 50-50, or is it the expected rate of 1As to type 2s at that ratio?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I can tell you how I treat it. You know, if you notice in just a second, you know, in this plot, if you go to these fainter objects, you see that the steps go up by a fraction of a supernova. Okay, so I just put
There's differences. If information, imagine when I go out and do a blind supernova search at 25th magnitude. Sorry, not blind. I use IR. I go to 25th magnitude.
Yeah.
And I do a supernova search. Typically, you expect the core collapse to 1A rate to be 8 or 9 to 1. That's a normal number. That's what
the rate.
That's the detected number of 1As to type 2s.
No, the detected are usually 1 to 1.
What redshift?
The high redshift, it's usually 1 to 1. I mean, you can see where the crossover is here, right?
Which depth of service?
I'm saying depth of 23, 24, something like that.
Yeah. You're usually dominated by 1As.
But my question is that as my information content goes to 0,
Why do you say your information content goes to zero?
Let's say I have bad photometry.
You're driven back to the prior.
You can't tell.
Sorry, you can't tell, but you know there's something there. It's not the same as
a
zero.
The question is, what do you classify that as?
Right. He's saying if you're expecting to see 10 1As for every 1-4 collapse, if that's the expectation at that depth, that a magnitude of 24.5, say.
I don't know what my expectation is. This is what I'm trying to measure.
Well, I'm saying that if
somebody else tells you, we know.
You're asking what the priors are.
Yeah, exactly. It's the priors. Yes, thank you. That's correct.
And so I guess I want to know when you say it's a 50-50 chance of being a 1A or a 2, what does that mean? Given that
he has no prior,
you're much more likely to find a 1A certain
brighter. I do have a prior because that information about its the relative brightness goes into the machine that tells you the probability.
But not the rate volume, but not the volume rate.
That's right. That's right. But to answer your question, Lars, if I did know that, I could easily put it in.
Oh, sure. No, I understand.
Okay, yeah,
But you've done this because you have a prior. I mean, like Eric said, you don't have a prior on the rates. You do have priors on their luminosities.
Right.
So you're not surprised that you don't see core collapse at 1.6.
That's right.
Because you shouldn't see them.
No, I can't see them. Yeah.
So you know in that case, when you see it, it's not even if photometry is bad. Really bad.
That's right.
It has to be 1A.
That's right, and that's factored into the machine.
Can you say a little bit more about the absorption and the absorption model you've used? Because we found that to be a really big problem
in extinction.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we fit the colors, you know, that's one of the free parameters.
Okay. Presumably, you have a Bayesian model for the expected extinction as a function.
I think that we don't.
You have color errors just from remeasurement.
Yes.
And then you multiply them by 3 or some other number to get an extinction error, right? An absorption error.
Right. Yeah, 3.1.
So you have some number, and you know the question of whether that number is the same always, same in high extinction cases as low extinction cases, and so there's a lot of mystery.
That's right. You can start playing with your extinction curve.
I was just wondering what you had found. I mean, have you found that you're very sensitive to that or not very sensitive to that? Because it could make a big difference.
You're asking about the reddening curve.
Yeah. No, not just the reddening curve, but the assumed distribution in galaxies.
Yeah, so, for example, if you allow AD to be flat and a flat prior, then it's very easy to make your 1A start looking like type 2s that are heavy.
That's why the evolution would be very important.
That's right. But if you put in another free parameter, which is you let the extinction curve evolve as you wish.
Well, I'm happy just to fix it.
Then.
but that
could screw you up, sure.
Yeah. And I just don't know whether you've explored the dimensions along which that would cause trouble. Because
we haven't. We've taken just
a really serious problem.
Is this true that we've taken just one extinction curve? Yeah, we have.
That's the place to start.
Yeah.
Better than none.
Okay, I think. Let me just mention this. Do I have any time left? Okay. I'll just mention this. This is actually going to low redshift. Basically, this is the regime you were talking about. We all know that Sloan 2 was launched specifically in order to find supernovae. But we realized a few years ago that we can find lots of supernovae in Sloan 1 in the existing database, simply because many of the basically all the fields have overlap between adjacent fields. So, and sometimes there's quite a bit of time between them. So a large area of Sloan has been imaged more than once in these long and thin strips. So another student of mine, Asaf Horesh, has been actually gathering all these data and image subtracting them and looking for supernovae. And he's by the rate that he's finding, we found about 50 so far, looking at a small fraction of the data, there should be about 1,000 supernovae, 500 or 1,000. So that's, again, a very nice sample of supernovae where you'll have excellent data in terms of color, both about on the supernovae and on the host, and you can make these pretty color pictures too. Okay, so here are some nice examples. okay, over here, or here, or this thing. And you can sort of see that this is just part of a long strip from the empty parts here. And here's another pretty one that he found just a few days ago. Okay.
Right.
Okay, so. Okay, so you've said most of the main contaminant is AGNs.
Yeah, and I was also thinking a lot about lensing against even nearby stars, which are all around the sky.
That's very, very rare.
Okay. I'm not sure
we
wouldn't expect to find a few of them. Not that, you know, you find 1,000 of them, but I'm not sure we wouldn't expect to find.
No, certainly
wouldn't
be a million times rarer.
Okay. I don't mean because of lenses.
You mean micro lenses?
I mean nearby objects, nearby white dwarfs or neutron stars or dwarf stars so near us that are
lensing the background star.
Lensing something in the background.
Right? No, optical depth for that is.
There's a famous one, 8th magnitude, magnified from an 11th magnitude star that has a very low probability, but it was discovered.
There's just one
of those
yesterday.
Right.
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 Well,
right. Right.
These rates, and they're significant. I don't know if they're significant enough to be contaminant for use. That's why I was asking if you specifically considered it.
Yeah, no. You have to worry about much more serious things. Asteroids, sure.
If they're red, they're never blue. So that's
the color information probably.
For things like our HFC project and the Subaru project, asteroids are not a problem because the whole exposures take long enough that you see them moving even if they're very far away. AGNs, we root out with Subarus simply by they're doing the same field over and over again, the same things that are going up and down. I think we've found most of them already. And then chance coincidences, you mentioned. That's a possibility, but all these things that I've showed here are clearly associated with the galaxy.
Yeah, that's reassuring.
So the chances of... And Belvey, of course, finds things that are not in any galaxies. He doesn't... I mean, he keeps those, too, but I'm not showing you those, and we're not going to do anything.
So that's one of your criteria?
We have cataclysmic variables for the other thing that pop up.
No, it would be much stranger. Okay, all these things are things whose luminosity is comparable to a galaxy. That's not a
single one. They're in our galaxy.
In our own galaxy.
The Abel cluster comes three cataclysmic variables.
The Sloan is found a handful.
Yeah, did they seem to be associated with a galaxy?
No, they were
in the foreground.
Yeah. There were four
variables. The probability of seeing very close to...
I agree, but as soon as you do that, then you get rid of a bunch of dwarf galaxies, which are kind of interested in the radar as well, so...
Intergalactics, yeah.
No, little galaxies. I would say we found five or six supernovae in galaxies we could not see in our images.
In your case, out of about...
50.
Out of 50.
10%.
That's a bit surprising, because you expect the supernova to be where the stars are.
Same true.
Most of the stars 10% of the supernovae, necessarily bright stars.
Yeah, 10% of the high Z supernova we find are things we can't see out of.
Again, where we have trouble seeing the galaxy.
Yeah, high Z.
Galaxy could be M33 and winds.
Yeah, high Z, that is a problem. But okay, this whole debate is different for low Z and high Z.
Right.
Okay, so these are my conclusions. Cluster 1A progenitors must have a small delay, or alternatively, maybe the iron that we see has nothing to do with 1A. Maybe it was formed by some early population of the top-heavy IMF with supernovae that have yields that are completely different from what theoretical models tell us. It produced a lot of iron, and that's how it happened. Better cluster rates at both low and high redshift, which we're working on getting, can actually test this and tell us really what is directly, not through fossil archaeology, but directly what is the contribution of the different supernova types to enrichment. There's some preliminary evidence that the rate may depend not only on galaxy type or radio loudness, but also on an environment, which is very, very surprising. And with wide and deep supernova surveys, we can both get star-forming histories and delay functions, and learn something about progenitors and who produced what. While I take questions, maybe I'll show this last slide that I prepared early this morning following a discussion I had with Brian. There's many different measurements that can, in the end, tell you what fraction of all things that we think could become 1As actually become 1As. And it usually involves taking some observed number and then folding it through an assumed initial mass function. So I tried to compile all those that I could find, and these are the numbers that I got. If you take these numbers are actually published in this form. If you take the 1A rate and compare it to the star formation rate delayed by the chosen amount, you get what fraction of stars that were initially formed in this mass range could go 1A. So these two groups get these kind of numbers. There's the paper on the cluster abundances that I showed at the beginning of my talk, which if you take it as at face value with the equal number of 1As and core collapse gives this huge fraction. If you take the iron mass in clusters and assume that all of it was produced as 1As, as most people believe, you get this kind of fraction. If you go now to the new fashion with fast and slow components, that also gives you these kind of numbers. Most of the things that go 1A are in the fast component. And there's this something of a large discrepancy between these authors and Lars and Evan. Maybe you can tell.
Our number really came from the
Minucci. Yeah, but also
the information is three times lower than the Minucci. It's all in the wrong paper.
That's the source of it.
The source of it is that the Sullivan et al. Result for the piece that tracked star formation had a normalization with MDOT, but three times lower than from the Minucci result.
And this is by mistake, or just because that's
no,
what they chose?
No, I think it's where we're at in our understanding. Okay. It's where we're at in the measurement.
Okay, so
I think this will get, hopefully will get cleaned up. I mean, I don't think there's errors. I think this is where we're at.
So if you just squint at these numbers and ignore for the moment the slow component, which is pretty small, all of them are sort of in the few percent to 10% range, and I think that's embarrassingly large for our current ideas of how 1As form. Because remember, this is the fraction of all things that are in this mass range. If you now account for the fact that not all A stars and B stars are in binaries, and of those that are in binaries, a large fraction, the most, I would think, are at such large separations that they'll never form in a contact binary, then you get numbers that are of order one, saying basically everything that can explode as a 1A does. And this is quite contrary to what we've heard over the years, that you need very fine tuning in order to produce a 1A in the end.
Just earlier in the week we were discussing how it's impossible to have a 1A.
Right. So these numbers, they, in my mind, they're very, very troubling.
Well, they certainly indicate that there's a lot to learn.
Yeah. And why the choice of 3 to 8? Why not 2 or 5?
Because Ken tells us that 3 is the minimum that you need to form after mass loss and all that to go over Chandra or close to Chandrasekhar.
You need a binary.
Yeah, you need a massive binary.
You need a massive white dwarf.
You need, okay, so
let's start with the mass.
8 solar masses will give you 1.2 solar masses. 3 will give you about 0.7 to 0.8. That's quite a difference.
Yeah, but you need at least half a Chandra's egg car mass on average.
Yeah. Well, then the 3 won't work. So, because you can, as in a couple of weeks in the conference, Curtis Williams will show you the initial mass, final mass relation as it has evolved. And Pleiades and Praesepe, progenitor stars that make the white dwarfs in those two clusters are 3-ish. And they make 0.7.
That's even worse.
0.8.
But the good news is Ellie's egg glitch is still probably okay because you can go down to 0.1, right?
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, as I said, we may have abandoned that mechanism too early.
Which one?
The edge glitch detonations, which are lower mass. And I mean, I'm not saying they're right. I'm saying at this point, we keep a very open mind.
You don't need like companions.
Well, I liked that idea 15 years ago at the EcoFest in Elba, and Eco listened to my talk, and he said, Liebert, I've never seen you give a talk with such passion and enthusiasm, but I don't believe a word of it.